Hello there, and thanks for joining us. It's Wednesday, February 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a congressional report says senior Trump administration officials pushed a project to share nuclear technology with Saudi Arabia.
They describe raising concerns, different officials who are in senior roles saying, no, we're not going to do something, and then someone ignoring those orders and continuing on with the work, particularly with this proposal.
A young British woman who left to join ISIS is found in a Syrian refugee camp. Trump ally Roger Stone is ordered back to court after posting a photo of a judge on Twitter. Also ahead, a fashion icon has died. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, perhaps the biggest achievement of the first summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un was that it happened at all. But when the two leaders meet again next week, that likely won't be good enough. More from VOA's Bill Gallo on the high expectations for the second Trump-Kim summit in Vietnam.
Last year in Singapore, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un agreed to work toward the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. In Vietnam, there will be pressure to clarify what that idea even means and how to start implementing it.
I think there's pressure on both sides to have a tangible outcome, unlike the first summit. Otherwise, I think it's going to be branded a failure, and then we're back to square one.
The U.S. wants North Korea to take a tangible step towards dismantling its nuclear weapons, such as destroying a key nuclear site or providing a list of its nuclear and missile inventory. North Korea wants the U.S. to provide sanctions relief or a formal end to the 1950s Korean War. But the most productive outcome could be an agreement to hand the process off to lower-level officials.
The two leaders of the countries can't solve everything themselves. I don't think they have a thorough enough understanding to be able to take care of some of these really complex issues that you're going to need scientists on, that you're going to need technical experts on.
There are signs Vietnam will be more substantive than Singapore. In preparation for the summit, U.S. officials have held more working-level meetings with their North Korean counterparts. And in Vietnam, the two sides will have 2 days of meetings rather than just one to make concrete progress on a nuclear deal. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
Senior White House officials pushed a project to share nuclear power technology with Saudi Arabia, despite the objections of ethics and national security officials. AP correspondent Chad Day says the information was garnered from the Democratic-led House Oversight Committee, which opened an investigation Tuesday into the claims by several unnamed whistleblowers who said they witnessed abnormal acts in the White House regarding the proposal to build dozens of nuclear reactors across the Middle Eastern kingdom.
Right now, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have expressed concerns that transferring nuclear power to Saudi Arabia without the proper safeguards in place could lead to them weaponizing the material and having another nuclear power in the Middle East.
Ethics officials were also concerned that then National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was pushing the idea to share nuclear power technology with Saudi Arabia.
Because of Flynn's past work on this, there was a conflict of interest. They also raised objections about whether or not they were following the safeguards within the Atomic Energy Act. In particular, they were saying that deciding on that we were going to transfer this technology to a foreign country is something that has to be approved by Congress, has to go through all of these other interagency processes. And according to these whistleblowers, those weren't being followed in the early days of the administration.
The report comes at a time when lawmakers are increasingly uneasy with the close relationship between the Trump administration and Saudi Arabia. Trump has made the kingdom a centerpiece of his foreign policy in the Middle East as he tries to further isolate Iran. In the process, he has brushed off criticism over the killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi and the Saudis' role in the war in Yemen. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. President Trump targets California for challenging the border wall declaration. Venezuela's defense chief says troops there will remain loyal to Maduro. Turkey's president recommits to buying Russian missiles despite U.S. warnings. And a billion-dollar business in the U.S. goes to the dog walkers. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at VOAnews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And now, turning to the humanitarian crisis in Syria, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says she's alarmed at the rising number of civilian casualties due to intensified attacks by Syrian government forces and their allies against Islamic State militants and other rebels in northern Idlib and surrounding areas. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
Syrian forces and their allies have escalated ground-based bombardments in the so-called demilitarized buffer zone in recent weeks. The zone includes Idlib and areas of northern Hama and western Aleppo governorate. The zone was created by Turkey and Russia in September to avert a Russian-backed Syrian army offensive against rebel groups in Idlib. The northwestern region is the last major part of Syria outside the control of President Bashar al-Assad's government. The United Nations had warned an attack in Idlib, where 3 million civilians were trapped, would trigger a humanitarian catastrophe. This agreement, however, has been unraveling since December. UN Human Rights Commissioner Michelle Bachelet says the recent surge in fighting has caused numerous civilian casualties. She warns that about 1 million people are in a very precarious situation. Her spokesman, Rupert Colville, says the High Commissioner is calling on all warring parties to ensure civilians are protected and all military operations are conducted in accordance with international law.
Large numbers of civilians, including hundreds of thousands of displaced people in Idlib and northern Aleppo, are living an intolerable existence. They're trapped between the escalation of hostilities and bombardment on the one hand, and on the other, they're forced to live under the extremist rule of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and other extremist fighters who regularly carry out targeted killings, abductions, and arbitrary detention.
Colville says Bachelet also worries about the well-being of some 20,000 people who have fled Islamic State-controlled areas in eastern Deir ez-Zor governorate in recent weeks. They are living in makeshift camps run by Kurdish armed groups, including U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. Colville says they reportedly are being prevented from leaving the camps. He says the High Commissioner is particularly concerned about some 200 families who are being held hostage by IS in the area under its control. He says the families, including many women and children, are being subjected to intensified air and ground-based strikes by U.S.-led coalition forces and their SDF allies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, as the effort continues to defeat Islamic State's last stronghold in Syria, a 19-year-old British woman who left her home in London 4 years ago to marry an ISIS fighter was found in a Syrian refugee camp just last week when she gave an interview to a reporter from The Times. And it's making headlines because she wants to return to the UK, but isn't making a good case for that to happen. I spoke to London-based reporter Amy Gutman about it. She says the UK Home Secretary has also just announced the woman's British citizenship is being revoked.
Shamima Begum was 15 when she and two friends of hers from school decided to leave their East London homes, hop on a Turkish Air flight, fly to Turkey, and then make their way into Syria, where they set out to become ISIS brides. They had a romantic view of this, and they felt they were going for an important cause. In the case of Shamima Begum, 10 days after her arrival in Syria, she married a Dutch convert to Islam who was a member of ISIS. She went on to have, she claims, two children with him. Each of them died, she claims, from malnutrition and the conditions and lack of medical care. And yet last week, she was 9 months pregnant with her third baby. And on that occasion, she was visited by a Times reporter. She said she wanted to return to the UK for the sake of her baby because she knew that the National Health Service would look after her child, and that's all she wanted. Except it caused a lot of furore over here because of her reaction to some key questions about how remorseful she was. Ever since this story has come out, it has been in the headlines day after day for the past week, which is a big deal if you consider the fact that we're on the brink of Brexit. Besides Brexit, this is all anyone can talk about, and that's because this girl believes that people should be sympathetic to her and should understand the fact that, of course, she doesn't want to bring up her baby in a Syrian refugee camp. On the other hand, she's been asked now on two occasions by two different reporters reporters about whether she is remorseful about having made this decision. This is a really big point because a lot of sympathizers and her parents have come out saying she was brainwashed, she was only a child, how could she know her own mind? Her sympathizers believe that she should be allowed back in this country. Other people are really interested in how she responds to these questions of, are you sorry you did it? And what's fascinating is that Shamima Begum's response to these questions about whether she regrets going to Syria and whether she regrets marrying a member of ISIS, her response is no. And this is what has really mobilized people in this country. She has come out and says she does not regret her decision. It hasn't worked out the way she had hoped. Her husband has now surrendered to Syrian forces, and she saw many people die. One of the first things that was so explosive in the Times interview was that she mentioned having seen heads in trash containers and not being fazed by that.
So she's not sorry about joining ISIS, and she's seen horrific things and doesn't seem remorseful about that.
No, and I think what really sealed her fate was the Sky interview that came out overnight, in which the reporter specifically asked her whether she would like to apologize. In fact, serving up on a plate to her an opportunity to win over public opinion and get people on her side to let her back into this country. He asked her if she would like to express any form of apology to all the innocent people, all the innocent Brits who have been killed through various acts of terrorism committed by people who claim to be doing so for ISIS, specifically citing the Manchester Arena attack back in 2017, where 22 people were killed, many of them young kids who were there for an Ariana Grande concert. And her response to that was that, of course, she's never happy to see innocent people killed, and it's never a good thing for innocent people to be killed, never right, but that it was essentially the same thing. She equated it to the innocent people in Syria who were being bombed in ISIS territory. And she said this was justified retaliation. I believe this is what sealed her fate and what drove the Home Secretary to announce that he was revoking her British citizenship, which would prevent her from returning to the UK.
All of this, of course, comes on the heels of demands from the US president for European countries to do more to take back some of the foreign ISIS fighters and put them on trial.
Actually, what Trump has said is that Europe in particular has about 800 foreign fighters who are going to be coming back anyway. He's made a point to say you need to put these people on trial because otherwise it's going to be a disaster. These people will be in the communities spreading hate and there'll be violence. It's a difficult territory when you have someone like Shamima Begum who hasn't actually committed a crime. Sympathizing with ISIS, unfortunately, is not a crime. So while most people find it morally reprehensible, there isn't a crime to try her for.
All right, London-based reporter Amy Gutman, thanks for being with us. A federal judge Tuesday ordered Roger Stone to appear in court to consider whether to revoke his bail after the longtime Donald Trump confidant posted a photo on Instagram of the judge with what appeared to be crosshairs of a gun. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson now said Stone must show up for a hearing Thursday afternoon and prove why she shouldn't modify or revoke his bail or implement a full gag order in his case. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
Judge Amy Berman Jackson has already issued a gag order limiting comments about his pending case. Now the judge says Roger Stone must prove why his bail shouldn't be revoked and why she shouldn't institute a full gag order in the case. After he posted the photo Monday, Stone apologized and said the picture had been misinterpreted. Stone has pleaded not guilty to lying to Congress, obstruction, and witness tampering related to discussions he had during the 2016 election about WikiLeaks. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Oil-rich Venezuela's near economic collapse may make it easier for opposition leaders to reverse socialist policies instituted by former President Hugo Chavez if they're able to oust his successor, President Nicolas Maduro, from power. VOA's Brian Padden reports that the country's socialist model discredited new Venezuela leadership allied with the U.S. would be expected to embrace strong market reforms.
In the last 5 years, Venezuela's state-run economy has shrunk by nearly half. Hyperinflation triples the prices of goods every month and has driven millions abroad to escape increasing poverty at home. Chronic food and medicine shortages have undercut the heavily subsidized programs for the poor instituted by former President Hugo Chavez and continued by his successor, Nicolas Maduro. With discontent growing even among Chavista supporters, there are increasing expectations that the Venezuelan people are ready for change.
I do think at the very beginning, because the Venezuelan people have suffered so much, they're going to be willing to give a lot of political capital to the new leadership to do a lot of these changes.
Nosotros.
That is, if opposition-led efforts succeed to force Maduro out after he banned opponents in last year's election. The U.S. and other countries have recognized Juan Guaido, president of Venezuela's National Assembly, as interim leader. A U.S.-allied government in Caracas would likely accept international aid that Maduro is blocking, along with loans in exchange for privatizing state-controlled industries and cutting government subsidies. Fighting inflation by cutting social programs and price controls will likely be the top priority, a move that economists say could actually help the poor by allowing the free market to work.
The moment you move from very high inflation to low inflation, the first thing that you see is a dramatic reduction in poverty rates.
Privatizing Venezuela's state-owned oil and gas company, PDVSA, could greatly increase revenue, especially after the U.S. eases oil sanctions. The company has seen production drop by two-thirds in the last decade due to a crumbling infrastructure and gross mismanagement.
These are things that, in principle, could get off the ground relatively quickly for Venezuela to restart its oil production, or at least, you know, recoup some of its oil production, which has been falling dramatically.
The next government in Caracas would likely seek to restructure its debts to creditors like China and Russia and end free oil shipments of an estimated 50,000 barrels per day to Cuba, all key allies of Maduro. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
Thousands of people have been rallying across France after a surge of anti-Semitic attacks in recent weeks that culminated Tuesday with vandals defacing dozens of graves in a Jewish cemetery with swastikas and anti-Jewish slogans. We hear now from Paris-based reporter Catherine Field about what's been happening.
There have been some 60 rallies right across France on Tuesday evening. There were Paris, Marseille, Bordeaux, Nantes, all of the big cities. It all really got the impetus from last Saturday when there was a group of these so-called yellow vest protesters were filmed harassing a well-known French philosopher. He was the son of a Holocaust survivor. This group was harassing him as he was walking through a Paris neighborhood. On top of that, we've also had several incidents that have been really touched the core of this nation. For example, a bagel store in Paris was spray painted with the word Juden, the German word for Jews, that was written in yellow letters. And also portraits of Simone Veil, a Holocaust survivor and magistrate in France who died very recently. Portraits of her were defaced with swastikas. So these are incidents that have happened really just in the last few weeks. And it touched a nerve. The political classes were very moved by it, as well as some of the other religious movements. And they came together, some 50 political organizations, unions, and associations, and said that on this Tuesday night, it was time for people to come out and say, that's enough.
I also saw that more than 80 graves were desecrated at a Jewish cemetery in eastern France, and the president had visited there since that happened. But that's just another horrific incident.
Indeed. These rallies were already long since planned when news came through early Tuesday morning that overnight more than 80 graves were desecrated with swastikas at a Jewish cemetery in eastern France. The French President Emmanuel Macron immediately went to that ceremony. He traveled up there. He met with people there. He said it was important that he was there, that he was with them today. And he promised that the full force of the law would be put to making sure those who carried out this deed would in fact be punished. So this news coming through this same day as these rallies really did bring home to people that this is something that's becoming more prevalent in French society, and that something has to be done to make people aware once again that this type of incident is just not acceptable.
And I understand that Macron will be making a speech later on as he attends a dinner, actually, at the Representative Council of French Jewish Institutions. So very timely as well.
Very timely. This, again, just by chance, this dinner has been on his agenda for some time, but he's decided that he's going to make this keynote speech at that dinner. Everyone will be looking at what he has to say, because clearly there are so many currents within French society at the moment that are quite disturbing. I mean, France does have one of the largest Jewish communities in Europe. There's around 550,000 people. That population has grown since the end of the Second World War. It's more than half of what it was then. The Jewish community is here. It feels as though it should be here, and it feels as though, you know, the French state should actually be doing more to protect it. So there will be a lot of interest in what the French president has to say and what measures he could take, because people aren't just looking for words now. They're looking at what changes should be done to, for example, the education curriculum, what children learn in school, what they learn about other religions. Because it's just not been on the educational curriculum in a strong enough form.
All right, Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. U.S. President Donald Trump signed a directive Tuesday to outline the establishment of the Space Force as the newest branch of the military. Space Policy Directive 4, which VOA obtained a copy of ahead of the signing, says the force will adapt U.S. national security to, quote, deter aggression and protect our interest in space.
Today, I'm thrilled to sign a new order, taking the next step to create the United States Space Force. So important when you look at defense, when you look at all of the other aspects of where the world will be someday. I mean, this is the beginning. This is a very important process. America must be fully equipped to defend our vital interests. Our adversaries are training forces and developing technology to undermine our security in space, and they're working very hard at that. That's why my administration has recognized space as a warfighting domain and made the creation of the Space Force a national security priority. I think we'll have great support from Congress, because they do support something when we're talking about such importance. With today's actions, we will ensure that our people are secure, our interests are protected, and our power continues to be unmatched. There will be nobody that can come close to matching us. It won't be close. What we have on the books are things that you wouldn't even believe. You wouldn't even believe. It's going to mean the safety of our nation for many, many decades and many, many generations. And that's what I'm here for. I guess when you get right down to it, more importantly than anything else, that's why I'm here.
Last week, the Defense Intelligence Agency released a report that found China and Russia have taken steps to challenge the United States in space by developing weaponized satellites, energy weapons, and surveillance networks. Two U.S. defense officials told VOA the legislative proposal for Congress to create the Space Force is expected as early as next Monday. The draft proposal estimates the Space Force will cost about $73 million per year over 5 years. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia, right here on The Voice of America.
Voice Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Iconic couturier Karl Lagerfeld has adapted and reassembled many of Chanel's most distinctive designs. AP correspondent Charles Ledesma reports.
Chanel's iconic couturier Karl Lagerfeld, whose accomplished designs, as well as trademark white ponytail and high starch collars, dominated high fashion for the last 50 years, has died. He was around 85 years old. Such was the enigma surrounding the German-born designer that even his age was a point of mystery for decades, with reports he'd had two birth certificates, one dated 1933 and the other 1938. Lagerfeld's designs for luxury labels quickly trickled down to low-end retailers, giving him an almost unprecedented impact on the entire fashion industry. I'm Charles Ledesma.
And finally, in our music segment on this day, February 20th, 1988, the world welcomed Robin Rihanna Fenty, now known as simply Rihanna. The R&B singer from Barbados has had this 2007 worldwide number one hit single, Umbrella, featuring Jay-Z. The song became the longest-running number one song in the UK in the 21st century. She has now sold more than 60 million singles, making her one of the best-selling artists of all time and the youngest solo musician in Billboard chart history to have 11 number one singles. Happy birthday, Rihanna. You're listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is the